I started working in Big Four accounting and quickly learned that I couldn't do that for 40 years. I was like, this is crazy. I don't know why anyone would sign up for this, right? And so I wanted to see, I thought there had to be a way without winning the lottery to kind of accelerate. Because at first it was about, how do I get out of this?
Welcome to the On Fire Podcast, episode 39, with your hosts, Matt and Kellen. In the On Fire Podcast, we discuss financial independence, real estate investing, frugality, minimalism, and retiring early.
But before we get into today's episode, what we need you guys to do is jump over on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to this on and leave us a 5-star rating and a written review.
Today's episode is with Chris from The Stealthy Rich. Chris is a very down-to-earth guy, while at the same time owning over 80 single-family homes and plus 200 units in apartment buildings. He has an amazing story to share.
Yeah, I've always loved the idea of stealth wealth, and I know it can mean a few different things to different people, but it's definitely a lesson that I learned the hard way in the corporate world is that it's oftentimes to be selective, or it's best to be selective with who you share your information with, especially when you're on your real estate, investing, or just financial independence journey.
But enough chatting. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors and then dive into the interview.
This episode is sponsored by the Findlay Mortgage Team. The Findlay Team was born out of the idea that through exceptional service and expert advice, they can create a world of more accessible capital for their clients. As real estate capital advisors, their mission is to assist investors in strategically scaling their portfolios. They understand the struggle that investors face and how difficult it can be to scale once the banks say no. Their experts find alternative solutions by leveraging institutional and private capital stacks, strong networks, and competitive products, allowing them to offer an industry-leading service that is unparalleled in the Canadian real estate market.
All right. So on the show today, we have The Stealthy Rich. So it's The Stealthy Rich is Chris and Dave. And on the show right now, we have Chris. And they kind of describe themselves as two normal family guys. They've purchased over 75 properties in the last 7 years. And the goal of it is for them to control their finances and do whatever they want with their lives. So they're kind of sharing their story. They have a website, thestealthyrich.com, where they share articles and their story. So thank you so much for jumping on the show, Chris.
Thanks, Kellen and Matt. Really appreciate your podcast. Happy to be here. I love talking real estate. So this is perfect for me.
Awesome. Well, glad to have you here as well, Chris. And I'm sure we'll dive more into this later, but I'd love to hear just kind of a brief summary or snapshot of what the last year has looked like for you.
Well, the last year. Okay. Well, obviously it's been unique for a lot of people, but we kind of went off the edge and bought 200 doors of apartments. And so for the last 7 years, we've been in single family houses, but in last November, December timeframe, we found a third partner and went all in on multifamily. So we have 200 doors in the Houston area that we're starting to get our teeth cut on. So it's been exciting. Other than that, I've just, been trying to stay healthy. It's been, I watch the news and Texas has been, I'm in Houston, been fairly insulated compared to everything else. We're fairly normal down here in terms of how everything is played out through the virus. But so we've been very grateful for that. But other than that, we're just trying to stay healthy and keep the real estate going.
That's awesome. So let's reel it back quite a bit, because I mean, you just bought 200 doors.
Yes.
Or so, which is amazing. So let's start right back at the very beginning. So, at a younger age or so, like what kind of brought you into the idea of financial independence and, real estate investing in the first place? What was your introduction into that?
Right. So I grew up in a very loving family, and my dad was always taught me the value of money. He worked for the same company for his whole career. Which is very common, I think, in those days. And so I went to college and I got a degree in information systems in the business school. And, started working in Big Four accounting and quickly learned that I couldn't do that for 40 years. I was like, this is crazy. I don't know why anyone would sign up for this, right? And so I wanted to see, there had to be a way without winning the lottery to kind of accelerate. Because at first it was about, how do I get out of this, right? So that the first answer was for retirement, right? And so I, kind of limped through a career with the Big Four, just kind of, I called it cubicle hell, right? And luckily one day back in 2013, I went to lunch and met Dave, who's my business partner now. And we were just kind of lamenting about, you know, our jobs. Not that we hated them, but just like they were, you know, they were very stressful and, you know, we were always tired and we were grateful for them, but still. And we said, there had to be something else, right? There had to be something better. And he had dabbled in real estate in law school in another city and had come over. He had now his job in Houston. And he said, hey, you know, we should get into real estate. And I perked right up because I always knew that real estate was the answer for me. And the reason I knew that is because before I dabbled so much in the market, right? Not day trading, but just trying to, you know, pick winners and follow the market. And I quickly learned there that I had less information than the big institutions, right? The big jumps always happened after trading or before trading. And I thought, you know what, I'm never going to get ahead here. And so when he said real estate, I said, we've got to do this. And so we started with five partners. They were all at that lunch, actually. And we bought over the course of probably 4 or 5 months, we bought 5 homes in Houston off the MLS, off the market, and kind of started this process of long-term rentals. And so then after that, Dave and I kind of split from those other guys very amicably, but just, you know, they weren't as passionate about it. And then we went on a tear learning all kinds of skills and creative ways to do things. And I think we bought over 80 different single family homes in the last 7 years. And then now we started with apartments. So it all started, you know, kind of wanting to understand how can I buy freedom or how can I shorten my life sentence in the cubicle, if you will. and so it was, you know, that was the incentive at first. And now I probably work harder than I ever have, but I enjoy it. And it's, and it's for me and my family rather than for an employer.
It's awesome. So over 80, like they were mostly single family homes?
Yes. Is
that for the most
part?
So
all those 80. Yeah. So, you know, it kind of started, we'd buy them and we had some really interesting financing. So like the first couple that we bought with those friends, one of the partners had some access to some interesting financing from Merrill Lynch, which was interest only financing, which was fantastic. So our, mm-hmm. like our first, I'll never forget our first house. I think it was $1,200 in rent. It cost us $90,000 to buy. And the monthly payment was $92 because it was interest only pegged on LIBOR out of London, which was like at the time was like 1.2%. And wow. So unfortunately, that's not normal. And so I was like, wow, this is great. We have like $1,000 cash flow every month. but the problem with those loans is that they did require 30% down. So we ran out of runway real quick in terms of down payments to buy houses. So we had to transition away from that financing eventually, but that's how we kind of got our jump start into it. Right. And so, yeah.
So like most investors are, you know, they're getting their first two or three. And then what was kind of the shift there in order to, like, you know, you're really wanting to scale up to that 75 properties.
Right.
What did the structure look like? What did the financing look like? Like, how did you approach something at that scale?
Good point. So we realized that, you know, we saw this journey and said, hey, you know, we're making, you know, $200 or $300 a month in cash flow in a normal property that wasn't interest only. Let's stay on a normal property. And we said, hey, we've got to get as many of these as we can, right? We have to scale this because I could see this being able to explode. And then also the fact that houses typically appreciate, right? So all of these kind of tools, if you will, were pointing in the right direction to say, we need as much of this as we can. And so what we did at first is we bought, Dave and I, once we kind of separated, we started buying the junkers, if you will, off the MLS, from real estate, right? So there are houses no one else would touch, either that terrible foundation or a bad roof or, you know, just a terrible looking place. And this is back in like 2014, 2015. And we were getting them for, you know, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000. And eventually those ran out, right? Because we stopped being able to find those. And so then we started doing direct mail. And that is really where I would say the bulk of our properties have come from, is by sending what we call yellow letters, which is it's just a piece of paper that we print on a cursive looking font that says, hey, I'll buy your house and, you know, call me. And I'm an IT guy. So I built our own list off the tax databases, the property tax databases here in Houston to kind of target exactly the kind of people we were looking for, people that have owned the house for a long time. So they probably have some equity, people who are non-owner occupied, so they don't live in the house, and you know, certain size, certain zip code, all those things. And so we'd send these letters out. We'd send about 1,000 a month, and we were buying houses at one point. We were buying one a month. And then your next question is, I'm sure, how were you able to do that from a financing perspective? And so at first we would use cash that we had for a down payment, and our lenders would do 15 to 20%. And I'll get into lenders in a minute, but quickly we then would run out of down payments. And so we would then get a house off a yellow letter or direct mail, and then we would flip it to have cash to then buy one or two more, long-term properties. And it was really sad. It was like giving away one of your children anytime we had to sell one of those. It was really sad. And so we wanted to avoid having to do that in the future. And that is when we were kind of introduced, or it kind of fell in our lap, the concept of BRRRR, right? The BRRRR method. And so, of course, which is to buy a house, to rehab it, to rent it, and then to refinance. And so those were the steps that we would do. And of course, and I can go through the numbers exactly, but let's just say a standard house for us, off a yellow letter, we'd pay $90,000 for it. And that'd be a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, about 1,500 square feet. And, you know, maybe a landlord had just had a tenant move out and they didn't want to refill it, or, you know, they bought it 10 years prior and they're just done being a landlord, and they sell it to us for, you know, $90,000. And let's say it needed, you know, floors and paint and, you know, odds and ends. And we spent $10,000 to get it rent ready. So now we're in at $100,000. We bought that house and we either used our own money or we used our rich friend's money or some, you know, some short-term money that we borrowed to get that house ready. Then we'd rent it, and then we'd call up our bank and we'd tell them we have this house. It doesn't have a loan on it, but we'd like a loan. And they say, great. And they would do an in-house appraisal and determine that it's worth, and this is easy numbers here, it's worth $125,000. And then they would give us 80% of that, which in this case would be $100,000. So they would give us $100,000, which would then make us whole. And we own this house. It's renting for $1,300 and paying us $200 or $300 a month. And we would repeat that over and over and over again until we couldn't find any more houses. So that's kind of where we're at today. But the BRRRR method is primarily the way that we are able to scale so fast and so efficiently, so quickly.
Appreciate that you're diving so deep into it, Chris. So we do have a lot of real estate investors that listen to this podcast, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of their ears perked up when you told us what's occurred in the last year in acquiring 200 units, as well as the shift in strategy. So before maybe even talking about that deal or the set of deals that made that and why you guys chose to pivot, for a lot of beginner investors that start off with small multifamilies, they're constantly thinking the grass is always greener on the large multifamily. Is that the case? Is that why you guys decided to move into this niche or strategy?
That is a fantastic question, man. And I think that the jury is still out, right? Because I always heard the same thing, right? I listen to all kinds of apartment podcasts and they're like, man, I skipped single family and went straight to multifamily and I never looked back, right? And I think the jury is still out for us. We've only been, you know, it's only been 6 months. We will see. I know that for our specific situation with single families, Dave and I have made it very lucrative for ourselves. And that's because we also self-manage. And so we have built, and I've heard on your podcast many times, we've built so many different systems that work very well for us. And it's very efficient for our single family homes. And of course, on the multifamily, we are paying a very good property manager, but we just feel a little more disconnected from that. And there's other, we syndicated that one. So we have some syndicated investors there. We are general partners on that one. But so we just feel a little bit more, it's like not quite our baby, if you will, right? And so, but maybe in a year when the financials get done, I'll be like, wow, why did I ever have these single family houses? But still, obviously the bulk of my net worth is tied to those single family houses. And so they're truly my first love. And I definitely am not trying to shed them or anything yet, because they have been nothing but productive and awesome for Dave and I. And so I'm hopeful. That's why we did the multifamilies, because we always heard how great it is. But, you know, it's not, I don't quite know the answer to that yet, but I'm hopeful in a year that I'll have an answer for you.
That's funny, because the next question I was going to ask is, like, what do you think the next 5 or 10 years is looking like at this point? Because, you know, so much of the focus was on the single family homes, now the large multifamily. You know, do you have any idea what that might look like, what your new plan might be? Because, I mean, so much of the value, like so much of you know, successful people, you find that they find a strategy and they rinse and repeat it, which is what you've done. And now it's switching up a little bit. So yeah, what do you think the future looks like?
Yeah, I mean, so there's so many people I hear them on your podcast and others where it's like they keep doing things, they keep going. At some point, I want to be done. Now that you could define what done means, right? But I don't think I'll ever, you know, just lay around. But at some point, I want to just kind of, you know, have a shift in lifestyle. And for me, the single family homes, once we either pay those off or get them in a position where we're out of what we call the growth mode and we're in the principal pay down or the cash flow mode, if you will, I think we've built enough, right? We're ahead now. And the apartments, I don't want to say they're too big, but I think my brain has not been able to wrap around the repercussions of owning those yet, right? And so, to be honest, I'm planning for the next 5 years of some significant inflation. We'll see if that comes to light. The Fed keeps trying to, and we hear stories of all these commodities going up, but they still say inflation has not happened, which I don't know how they track that stuff, but the stories are not aligning. But so if inflation does go up, and we've seen this even in Houston, which is typically our rents and our home values have just tracked with inflation over the last 15 years. That is not the case in the last year because of COVID and what else. The prices are going through the roof, right? Not as bad as other places like Denver and the coast and whatnot, but still, I mean, places are getting multiple offers on the first day. And our rents have also gone up significantly. And at some point, I can't see how my tenant base can afford to live in these anymore. And I don't know what replaces them. And so I'm hopeful. My goal was to buy as many assets as I could before a great inflationary period. And that is what I'm, you know, so my calculus is that we're going to have an inflationary period. And hopefully I will benefit from owning a ton of assets, right? And so, but I do, to your point, what is amazing to me is for every $30 that we raise rent on our apartments. So one of them, there's two buildings. One's 50 units and the other one's 145 units-ish. The 145 unit, for every $30 we raise rent across the board, that raises the value of the apartment by $1 million. And that when I hear numbers like that, that just blows my mind, right? And so, and we've already raised it like at $80. And so in 6 months, because it was way under rented before. And so, So yes, I mean, the next 5 years, I'm hopeful, unless prices come down, I don't see Dave and I acquiring a lot of other properties just because of comparison of where we bought and where it is now. And it just doesn't make sense to us financially, even though it probably still does for some people. And we have enough already. And so I think we're just trying to get into the cash flow stage of our investment and pay down a lot of these properties.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate you breaking that down for us. And so I kind of want to explore, you know, the stealthy rich. So
sure.
What's the importance of stealth and that stealth wealth or all that?
And yeah,
I guess it's something that I used to talk about a bunch on my channel. And I just realized it's been a while since I really chatted. So I'd love for you just to jump into it.
So, you know, the original book is not an original idea, but The Millionaire Next Door, right? I loved that book when I was younger. And the idea, and Rohit Sethi also has concepts like this, that, you know, Dave and I, we live in nice areas, but we, you know, he drives a 2010 Honda Accord a little bit older Honda Accord, and I drive like a 2007 Santa Fe, and, you know, and they work great and we love those cars, but neither one of us are a car guy. And otherwise though, we do have, like, we both have pools in our houses. We live in nice houses. And so I think for us, it's the idea that we spend our money on things that bring us value and that we don't spend money on the things that don't. I know that sounds really like straightforward, but for most people, I don't see that as something they follow, right? And so we're very meticulous on where we get value, and we spend money on that religiously. And then the stealth part of it is Dave and I both still had, when we started this, we both still have W-2 jobs. We do those because we still enjoy them and they bring us, you know, joy. And we were just trying to do this on the side, kind of just educate people on real estate and what we've learned and kind of document our journey to FIRE, right? And so, and I've kind of changed that term. FIRE movement was great. And like many of your other guests have said, you know, what's the end? For me, I've kind of changed that acronym to FLARE, which is financially liberated, able to retire early, but I'm not going to, right? And so,
I like that.
It's more of a flare than a fire now for me, but that's definitely that's where I'm at. And so like, I think in my ideal world, and maybe once I got there, it wouldn't be so ideal, but if I could just work 3 days a week, right? Or maybe three and a half, or maybe just every day for like 3 or 4 hours, then I'd be good, right? And then rest of my time, I'd be spending with my family, you know, carting them all over the place, or you know, helping other people, right, in my community. And so those are kind of the goals from the, so the stealthy rich is so much, not so much flaunting the wealth, but just having the wealth primarily built up in what we call net worth, right? And tracking that net worth, which is not based on material things, most likely it's based on, you know, either real estate investments or whatnot. And that is what truly will then bring you freedom in the long term, freedom from, you know, a job you hate, or a place you don't like to live, or, you know, and so forth.
Yeah. Appreciate you breaking that down for us, Chris. And I guess I've got a follow-up question here too, and just curious your thoughts and your personal experience, and I'll maybe first preface it with mine. So I also came up through the accounting world, worked for BDO originally, and then a publicly traded company afterwards. And I guess definitely an aspect of stealth wealth or stealth rich that comes to mind for me was, I feel like I kind of learned the hard way at the accounting firm. And then I made sure I didn't make the same mistake at my next employer, where I was obsessed with real estate. So I would just talk to anyone about anything to do with real estate. And I found that, you know, sometimes come promotion, that a partner would be like, well, can you really be that focused on your files if you're also building up this real estate empire? So love to hear just your general thoughts and opinions on that, Chris, and if you've got any experiences.
Yeah. So for me, it's basically like two worlds. And so I have my work world where I'm completely dedicated, and there's very few people that I share my personal world with. And so, I mean, only like one of them knows, one or two know about this persona, if you will. And so, and it also, but that's because I work remote. And so, you know, these aren't people I'm going to the office to every day, you know, physically with. And I've always worked remote, even pre-COVID. And then there's my local community where I can't shut up about real estate because I love it, right? And so anytime we're at a party, my wife is always like embarrassed because like I'm always in the corner with some guy talking about real estate, right? And so it really has been just a focused effort to keep them separate. And that has been, and again, a function of why we don't really share our identities on our profile or whatnot, is because, you know, we just don't see the need yet, and to keep it kind of separate from work and, you know, stealthy.
So, okay. So I have a kind of the elephant in the room that I'm surprised, like I'm sure some of our listeners might've been caught off guard there. You're still working a full-time job. Is that right?
That's right. So I'm an IT consultant. And so I work from home. I don't commute. And we have created this, and this is going to sound crazy, right? So Dave and I run this whole thing off the side of our desks, less than 10 hours a week, right? Probably five. And so it really is something. And I always tell people, right? It's like, how do you build something? You have a couple choices to build something to help you exit the WT workforce, right? You can either build your own business, or you know, win the lottery, or get rich in the stock market or crypto or whatever, or you can do real estate. And for me, real estate, with my knowledge and my personality, was the best way to do it while still giving an honest, you know, time to my employer. And that is, you know, my job is flexible in terms of, if you know, if I'm like, I'm doing this right now in the middle of the day, I don't have any meetings. And so that's okay. But, and then I'll work tonight, you know, got bang out some emails or whatever. But so being, you know, having that kind of job has made the flexibility to be able to own real estate.
The big follow-up question here, which, I mean, I'll give you some context. In London, yeah. Ontario here, where we are, there's a lot of people that we have a local community about financial independence. And a lot of people here, luckily, we have a lot of support because we're open with our friends about what we're up to. And we probably are a little bit quiet about our employers with it as well. But we end up getting this positive pressure from our fellow, you know, FIRE community members that are like, when are you going to quit your job, right? And I imagine you, I don't know how much pressure or how much, you know, how many people in your life are asking you that question, but it maybe you've been asked it a million times.
Oh yeah.
Why are you still working the job, right? Because like,
they ask me that all the time. No, you're right, Kellen. They ask me that all the time and they kind of make fun of me. Yeah, that's great. So, I always tell people I'm five bad days away, right, from quitting. So five bad days in a row. Yeah. And so like, if we got a rough time at work and they're like, okay, Chris, what day is this? Like, well, it's day three, you know? But no, truly, I work for an amazing company. It's small. It's typically not stressful, and I love it. Right. And so, but at some point, if I get put in a role that doesn't make sense, or if, you know, something changes there, I can't quit. I think it's more of, you know, we have a little bit different situation here in the US with medical insurance and whatnot that's still kind of iffy. And so my insurance is fantastic currently.
Yeah.
And so, and I got four kids. So it's like I'm one broken arm away from a disaster. So, but to your point, I think I enjoy my job. And, you know, Dave and I talk about that every day. He has an equally flexible job. He's a CFO for a trucking company. And it's, you know, we like our jobs, and so we still do them. But, you know, and to be honest, you know, once we get to the end, I'll answer your questions. But there might be, you know, maybe I should have quit my job already. I don't know. What could I have? So sometimes I ask myself, what could I have grown this to had I applied all of my mental forces to it, right, over the last couple of years? So yeah. We call them the golden handcuffs, right? They're the golden handcuffs. They keep us comfortable, but they limit our progress. I don't know. So,
well, the only reason I ask is, well, one of the reasons I ask is because, you know, I know, so Matt here, he quit his job, I forget how many years ago now. And then, you know, there was some pressure, positive pressure from him and a bunch of other friends that were like, when are you going to quit your job? And then a couple of years ago now, I quit my job. I worked in the tech world as well. You mentioned your information systems. Like I was working toward a master's degree in information systems. So similar kind of idea. And, you know, it was a part of my identity, but I wasn't super passionate about it. And for me, I didn't actually love my job like you do. But one thing we did notice with literally every single person I know who's been a successful real estate investor that has then quit their job is that they make more in that first 6 months after quitting their jobs, you know, than they had in any other 6 month period in their life. And God knows what the reason is, but I would imagine a big part of it is just they have so much more mental bandwidth. They have so much more time in their day.
And yeah, they put all their effort, right? No, I talk about it all the time, you know? And so the other day when I introduced myself to somebody new, next to my wife, I told them, I said, what do you do, Chris? I said, I'm a real estate investor. And my wife,